It should be time for us to begin this morning, so if you could go ahead and find your seats and open up your Bibles, the text of Exodus, and to the 16th chapter. We'll be continuing there shortly. We'll let everyone get settled real quick. If you'd bow with me in prayer, we'll begin our study in just a moment. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time where we can share study and consideration of your word. Please help us to be good students, to be mindful of our own weaknesses as we consider your will. Help us to be willing to change, to move to be closer like your plan for us would have us be. Please help us to mature in a healthy way and forgive us of our sins. And we pray this in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so we are in the middle section of the 16th chapter. We did not have time to fully go through the entire text on Wednesday, so we've got a little bit of leftover. Might be appropriate because we're looking at the initial aspects of the deliverance of the manna. We had a little bit of leftover in that passage too, and hopefully our leftover won't be as bad as theirs. What we're looking at here, though, is a series of firsts for Israel. We've emphasized that a couple of times. We're going to take a little bit of time this morning to revisit that idea. From our perspective, the story of Israel, the story of God's people, is all the way in antiquity. It's this time that we are very disconnected from. If you think about it, how well do you or I really understand the day-to-day spiritual life and the day-to-day physical life of an Israelite? Even if we've really invested ourselves into study, we might have an idea of what their routine on a day might look like. We might even have a very good understanding of the visual and practical aspects of both their physical day and their spiritual day, and all of the things that would be in there. But still, it's going to be all the way over there. It's hard for us to connect to it because it doesn't seem like our days. You ever had the power go out in your house for more than 24 hours? Okay, that's the first step to make our day like theirs. All right? That's the single factor that makes it incredibly difficult for us to make a connection to what it would have been like 100 years ago, 200 years ago, or 2,000 years ago. Because you know what air conditioning gives us? Comfort. And that's mainly because of electricity. That's really what makes air conditioning possible. It's not even lighting. We can do lights without electricity. A little smoky, a little hazy, but we still have light. That's a big factor to help us bridge that gap from, it's really not something I can connect to, oh, okay. So that means that every single thing that I do requires a little bit more of my physicality. I have to pick things up. I have to cut things. I have to saw things. I have to go forage for things. I have to physically go get them because I don't have all the mechanical advantage that electricity and maybe petrochemical knowledge with engines provide as well, to a certain degree. That gets us closer to understanding. But let's step to the other side of the perspective because that's about as far as we can get. On an emotional level. Maybe on a logical level we can get a little closer. But now let's get to the other side of the things. Every single step of this journey that God is bringing this multitude on is the first time they've done things. It's the first time as a nation they've had to trust Jehovah on a practical level. And that's different than trusting Him on a theoretical or a theological level. Oh, yeah, I trust God. I trust God has got it. But it's different when you're trusting Him with, say, food every day, physical safety every day, when you've never done that before. This is all the newness that Exodus provides to us. And like we talked about intentionally on Wednesday, the conduit for conversation is just one spot. One avenue. What's their avenue? How can they talk to God? Moses and Aaron is all that they know as a functional conduit to God. Does God hear their general prayers? Do we know that from an academic standpoint? Yeah, He hears their cries. He hears their complaints. But from a practical standpoint, when they want answers, it's going back to a single source. Moses is that single source. Aaron is that single connector to them. So then, all these firsts. So every time they come to a new first, a new level of trust, a new level of faith, a new level of fidelity, their complaints go through Moses back to God. Moses gets frustrated. Israel is frustrated. Do you think God is frustrated in that? The text actually tells us that sometimes you can see the personality and the emotion of Jehovah manifest itself in joy and sorrow and grief and angst and frustration, all of those things. So, a point to get, if we're going to use alliterations, the firsts of faith are frustrating every time. The first time your faith is tested, it will be frustrating. The first time Israel's faith is tested, it's going to be frustrating. The first time for our faith to be tested, will it be frustrating? You want some more F's? Fatiguing. And it may be fraught with failure. That's the end of the alliterations for right now. You know, we could probably have a few more. But you think about how faith kind of moves that way, where you move forward and then things don't go exactly like you want them to be. But I thought forward was over there, but God says forward's over here. In this construct right now, as they are being provided first food, the physical side of that, then water, and finally spiritual food will flow from the mountain to them. It's going to be, again, these fits and failures and starts and complaints and successes all mingled in with some really bad decisions on the part of some as they weed out a mindset that will take probably 1,000 years to fully flush from Israel. And that is the sense of idolatry is important. Because remember, and this is to help us get the bridging of the gap. After the three steps of Israel into captivity and the three steps of return back to reestablish Jerusalem, is idolatry really a problem in Israel proper of the Old Testament, or not the Old Testament, but of the physical kind? Spiritual idolatry still exists in Israel at that point. But are they really bringing in the Baals, the Molechs, the gods of the other nations in Israel at that point? No. But they're about to build a golden calf. So it takes a long time for Israel to kind of sort through one major commanding issue. So again, whenever we look back to this, remember that there's a lot of firsts for them. There's a lot of trust involved. There's a lot of inexperience. There's a lot of newness. There's going to be all of that in each of these, bits and pieces of the fullest sense of it. One thing that I find interesting, if we kind of scoot forward in chapter 16, and different translations render some of these aspects a little bit differently, so you might catch some nuances there. But verse 31, chapter 16, now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed. White, and the taste was like wafers with honey. Now pause for a second and go back and think about what you saw on the ground and what was familiar to them in the sense of their dietary history. What was the food they talked about being present for them in Egypt? The meat pots. You know, we said... Yeah. You know, if I describe that to you, it tastes like coriander seed. Raise your hand if you know exactly what coriander seed tastes like. Like two or three people might know. I've had it a number of times. I could not describe it to you. And I, you know, sometimes I can and sometimes I can't. But God gives us these pictures that are important for us. And so the reason I brought up all this study and research and tidbit things is to point this fact for us. Whenever you see God give you a descriptor that you can go out and verify, why not go out and verify it? Why not go out and say, hey, this is what it's like? So take a moment and maybe make a note to yourself and say in the next couple of weeks, you're going to try to figure out what coriander seed tastes like, a little bit of honey, a little wafer flake, you know, try to put it together. Because that will combine something powerful for you. The spiritual side, which we are a spirit, we are a spiritual being, we do have a soul, we have intellect beyond the flesh, but it connects it to the physical side. That you can personally experience something. And that's a rarity. Because this is a spiritual experience for Israel. They're seeing God manifest His power to them. And they're trusting Him. So we can do that. How often is it that we get to combine a physical and a spiritual experience? We hint at a location. Do you remember what your baptism felt like? The emotional side of it, coming up clean of your sins. Maybe the water wasn't that clean, but you were. You remember that? That's a powerful thing that God doesn't give us constant reminders of. We'll do this, you'll see it. But when we can find it, let's do it. So I want to encourage you. I haven't given much homework in this class, but this is homework, if you will. And come back next Sunday if you have time between now and then. I don't know if I'll be able to be successful because I won't be near my regular shopping circle. But it was an experience if you've been successful in it. And say, this is what it's like. And it's not so much what everyone else thinks it is. You're going to be able to say, this is what it was like for me. Have those flavors together, that idea together. And you can go to the internet. There's actually recipes all over the internet that tell you how to simulate things. And so go on with that homework and do your best and see how it goes. I'll be looking forward to see what kind of success level we have with that. Back into the text. We move back just a little bit. And this is all the way back down to verse 22. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay aside to be kept till the morning. Now, there you have a layer of a text. Is that a pretty clear introduction into a Sabbath rest? If you were to talk to a Pharisee, a Sadducee, a militant Israelite of the first century, and say, what's the Sabbath all about? How many different answers would you get? As many of different people you asked, they would all have different detailed answers. The reason I say that to you is that Israel by that time had developed a calculated methodology to understand the application of what the Sabbath would mean. Well, if you're going on a journey, you can't really go on a journey because it's a day of rest. But if you travel a certain number of miles, just enough but not too much, and stop and have a small snack, you've made your home again. You can then travel a second time, and a third time, and a fourth time, and you haven't traveled on your day of rest. But you ask a different one that says, no, you can't travel that far. You've got to travel this far before you have your snack. Oh, it can't be a snack, you've got to make a campfire. They had created a calculated methodology to escape the principle of God's will by hedges, loopholes, little peepholes through different things and say, well, squeeze through here because God didn't really super specify that to us. Now, remember, the Pharisee was not so much about rigid acceptance of the law, but escaping the law. Their goal was to get around it. That helps us understand the Pharisees a little bit better. But if you went back to this text and talked about the generality of God's testimony to Moses and Moses' expectation to Israel at this point, Is it really any difficulty in figuring out what the Sabbath was about? Make your food ahead of time. It's a rest day. Pretty simple, right? I mean, at this point, you know, you said it's a day of solemn rest. Now, we haven't had the full law yet. We don't have more information. We don't have some additional structure. But right now, we have the principle down. But this is a big thing. And two words are used that are important for us to understand the principle in application. Solemn and holy. Solemnity, or solemn, is an idea that I think we can kind of gather if you go to certain assemblies. Certain aspects of a funeral, certain induction aspects of putting into office, solemnizing a vow of marriage. Everyone's pretty sullen and solemn when they're signing paperwork for a loan because the significance of the weight is upon you. Every stroke of the letters, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. You know, you're buying your first automobile and you're writing the check from your checkbook because my first automobile was payable by cash. You know, and not much, but it was all that I had. Solemn occasion, all right? But it's not just solemn. Not just sullen and impactful in that regard. It's holy. In a very practical way, what does the word holy mean? Set apart. And every ounce of our families have things of a secular nature that we keep holy. Right? Are there things that go in the garage that are absolutely never to go into the house? Right. You're keeping them holy. And there's a reason for it. Because garage things have garage thing smells. And sometimes, like, you know, the little bag of leftover whatever goes out there until you take it to the trash because it's defiled. And it's not necessarily so much that it's better, that it needs to be isolated. Holiness on the practical level can be understood that way, where you need to keep it because it's got a special purpose. There's a plan for it. You've isolated it. There's something important about it that goes beyond just, okay, I got to keep it over there. Because here's the understanding of it. When you talk about some of the regulations that God had for Israel in Leviticus, in Deuteronomy, even here in Exodus, to the modern mind, going back to where we started, they seem arbitrary. Well, why would they not mix? And what? It seems arbitrary because we've lived a life without that distinction. All things are now clean to us. We can go ahead and have things that have been unclean animals prepared for us, cook them successfully and eat them, and everything's okay. But to the Israelite, they are being trained to understand that some things are worthy of distinction, worthy of separation. And in fact, we have to remind ourselves they are not arbitrary distinctions. It's not just because God threw up a little bunch of things in the air and said, all right, can't have those. You can't have these. The primary rationale for us to understand these distinctions that they're going to get is because they would teach Israel what they needed to know. It's not that medicinally one's better than the other. It's not because the flavors are different. It's not because one's culturally different in that sense as a primary means. The primary means is it would teach Israel important truth. So, one of the big things that they begin to start early on, even before the arrival of the covenant and of the commandments and of this formal law of Moses, is that the Sabbath is a solemn and holy rest. 6 days of gathering. They don't go out and gather on the Sabbath. That's going to train them in ways that they don't understand yet. Just as they were being trained to move between being a slave people and a free people, and they were being trained to no longer be a servant people, but to be a people fit for war, they're going to be trained to see the value of a spiritual set-aside, of a time to recruit their inner selves in that sense. Because One of the things, of the many things that the Sabbath perspective teaches us, is that there's a spiritual component to that action too. Remember, it's not merely a physical thing. And we sometimes think of the old law as heavily physical, and in part it is, because there's a lot of practicality of sacrifice, of arrival, of timing, of X, Y, and Z, of cleansing, of all those things. But there's a spiritual side to it. So my question right now, before we get back into the particular passages, up to this point, not jumping ahead too much to the old law, particularly of Moses, or even Christ's comments on it, what is the spiritual significance of a Sabbath day at this point for Israel? Yeah, that this day is different than the other days. It makes it special. So there's some specialness to it. And that specialness is more than a physical specialness, because some days are physically special. They're physically special because they involve the harvest, or they involve changes, or there's a dynamic visual significance to them where the seasons change. That's a physical significance. But this is going to be spiritual because it's going to be ongoing. Every Sabbath, this day is going to have a difference to it. And the difference isn't going to be, it's going to be felt this way. There's some physical ones too. Because what will they not be doing on the Sabbath? They will not be going out to gather and glean, and eventually they will not be working in that practical sense. They will be, hopefully, thinking on these spiritual sides of things. What else can we gather at this point about the Sabbath? And you can reach forward a little bit too, if you feel the need to do so. I heard a little hint of something. Right, they're going to be closer knit. If they follow the full prescriptions of the idea of the Sabbath and don't Pharisee their way around the hedge, they'll stay close. They'll be tied together. That's going to create bonding potential, connection. Remember from last Sunday in our time together in worship and praise that we talked about the power of being together as a family of God's people? Well, that's going to force that time, going to structuralize it. Because if you're off all doing your chores, and your chores could be a mile apart and out of direction, there's not that opportunity for connection. Plus, in the long run, on the Sabbath day, everyone's routine changes. You know, whatever would be involved in the food preparation, that's done. Whatever is involved in the work providing to pay the bills, if you will, whether the bills come in food, physically, or in cash, depending on the time frame, that stops. It's supposed to stop too. So they can renew the connections they have to one another. Another powerful pinpoint. Furthermore, it creates a framework of understanding. It actually creates the week. We are kind of beholden to the idea of the week, right? People say the weekend. And literally, what should that actually kind of refer to? The ends of the week. The beginning of the week and the end of the week takes place on the weekends. We refer to it as the weekend because we think it. Our worlds start when? Everyone's afraid of Monday, right? Oh, Monday's awful. Monday is a day like any other. You wake up for it. Well, the reason it's different is because your schedule changed. For the most part, and some of us have had jobs that are really all over the place time-wise, and they don't always start at the same time. But for the most part, we have consistency in our lives. And Monday is when that gears back up. And we don't like it because we like our weekends. Both the rest of the Saturday and the rejoicing of the Sunday. Think about it that way for us. But this codifies it. And it connects it. I remember vividly some political punditry about this question, but in how many days did God make the heavens and the earth? Six. The uninitiated, what do they answer? Seven. But it's six. Throughout the scriptures, from Genesis to Revelation, this picture of 6 + 1 equaling seven in the regards of creation, spiritual matters, bigger pictorial matters, and the prophets comes up. So understanding that big picture of the Sabbath rest becomes a little bit more connectable. You can kind of put it together and squeeze on it a little bit. Because, oh, okay, that was like Israel, and God rested. You think God was tired? No, he's not like the gods that of the false prophets, and he's not out, you know, inclined in that sense. It was completed. It was finished. Then it was very good. The entirety of creation is seen in that fullness there. And then he's like, okay, let's rest. You can think of the day of rest as a day of reflection, because that connects it to the spiritual side. Also add this, it's vital for us then to understand this. If God rested and reflected, if Israel was commanded to rest and reflect, do you think we need that too? Do we need to rest and reflect? Are we very good about doing it consistently? I'll tell you for me, no, I'm not. I don't know, you can answer for yourselves. But we need it. And we should actually maybe be more mindful of the value of it. And you get to see that here, that God is bringing that full perspective out. The text continues back into chapter 16 again, particularly picking up verse 24. So they laid it aside in the morning, as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink. That's a good point, because remember what happened the first time. And there were no worms in it. Oh, that's also good too. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. So even if they were to want to go out and get a little more, not there. The balance, then, of my earlier points about the value of rest. Rest only has profit if it's preceded by work. It only has that kind of full value to us unless we've done something connected to it to see the transition. As valuable as rest is, if every day is rest and reflection, and no days are work and profitability, of what kind of person do you end up becoming? The Proverbs talk about it, by the way. Lazy. Slothful. The Proverbs talk about the sluggard who should consider the ant. And so there's some good perspective on the physical side. Add it up. If it's good for us in the physical sense to have those days of work with the days of rest and reflection, when God tells us to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, we'll be putting some work into our spiritual sides on the other 6 days of the week. Yeah. Because when we come to rest and reflect, how much more valuable will it be? It'll actually be refreshing rather than frustrating. Because if you ever come to a Bible class that you really enjoy the class, but your work schedule has been of such that you hadn't had the time to really prep for it like you like, and people start talking about things in Bible class, have you ever been frustrated when you can't keep up? Oh, that's brutal on me. My personality is not good with that. It doesn't even matter if the subject was something even interesting. If you can't keep up, then it hurts. That's that 6+1 perspective to think about the preparation to the spiritual realization at the end. A lot of, again, what takes place here is the introduction of firsts, if you will. One more thing takes place, and this is in verses 28, 29, and 30 of importance for us this morning to catch on to. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place for the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Why did that happen? I skipped verse 27 on purpose. Why did it happen? Right. Now, he had already said there won't be any there. Right? and they still went out to go find some. I know you've probably been in the shoes of the person telling like God was, but have you thought about the times when you're in the Israelite shoes and someone had told you, don't do that. Here's why you shouldn't do that. And you still went and did that. Remember the fatigue and failure of the first of their faith, the frustration? This is when God is basically saying, I just told you not to, and you went and did. And when I that's the tone I read God's voice there, by the way. This is just like this frustration. It's not a frustration of anger at all, although it can rise there. It's the frustration of, come on, people. Is this a complicated expectation of God? Some of His expectations in the Old Testament required stages. Things you had to get together in the right sequence and coordination. Is that this right here? It's like the land of simple expectations. Further, they had all that they already needed. If they follow the day 6 instruction, the day 7 is a cakewalk. A literal manna cakewalk. But they don't. But to be fair, is it all of them? This is some. Does any of that change throughout any of the story of God's people? Are there always some who are struggling? Yeah, there are. And whenever I say some, I want to remind us that it's maybe just one, and it may be me. Maybe you. We may be the one who's struggling. If it's always that way, and by the way, it's always going to be that way, that changes our perspective on how we treat one another. That we might not even know why someone's going out to get manna. And that's the alliteration of the illustration of the idea in that sense, that we don't know why someone's going out to chase after the world, to go back to their prior way of living. We don't know all the whys because we're not in their shoes and we're not beating their heart next to ours right there. But understand that God's frustration doesn't change. I just told you not to and you went and did. Our heart needs to be able to beat in tune with God's and have that same level of frustration, but deep in tune with God's too when it talks about the patience of restoration. He's very patient with his Israel. He keeps bringing them back. He's bringing her back, yeah. Yeah, I think it's powerful that God doesn't say all the reasons why. He just said that they did. Because the expectation was like really simple. Don't go do that. My personal curiosity, I understand that motivation. I wonder if it's out there. Wonder if it's out there. What if I put a window right here looking through the field and I wouldn't be out? I understand. But I also understand that people are motivated by a million other reasons. Hey, I'll get a little extra. And then when Monday morning rolls around, I won't have to get up and go out there and glean the field. But I got a little extra. I got the choice time. It's all the same. They're going to get tired of it, by the way. They get tired of what God provides. Which is our tie-in right here. What God has presented to them is a very simple construct of commitment, of trust, and provision. He's created a relationship with Israel built on this covenantal idea that they are His people and He will provide for them. They will have what they need. Their expectation then is to do what God asks. That simple connected relationship provides for a generation of people everything that they need. They have their spiritual needs met. They have their physical needs met. To even the extent that their belongings subsist in a supernatural way. They don't have the same wearing out problems that ours do. And they grow tired of it. It becomes to them as nothing. Now, here's the point that is a good spiritual truth for us. A lot of times in discussions about the nature of God and His capacity to do X, Y, and Z, people will say, why doesn't God fix that? And we're not even talking about big things, the problem of evil. We're not even talking about the problem of wicked behavior in evil nations. Why doesn't He fix poverty? Why doesn't He provide clean water to Africa? Okay, is there any Bible example of God doing that, and how do people respond? People don't change. Individuals don't change. No matter what the outcome is, you're still going to have a sense of response that is, God who? I don't care about what God's doing for us or not doing for us. This gives us some good insight to understand how we approach those questions with others. Because those are legitimate questions that I've been asked, and people do feel deeply about them. You've got to remind yourself to turn away from this theoretical question and make it personal. What about you? How have you responded positively to the blessings that God has already given you? And they already have a bunch. If they accept that God exists, and they're already at that point, then the blessings that God has presented to you and I are abundant. Opportunity for gainful employment, care when we didn't have that job, someone took care of us, either our nation, our family, our friends. We scrapped together an existence where God blessed us with rain and showers and any number of things. Further, He blessed us with discipline and admonition. He blessed us with redemption when we're ready. So grappling with what He's already blessed us with, or maybe even challenged us by, is a more powerful question than the, well, how come God doesn't just snap His fingers and fix the problem? Because He's done that at times when need be. And those were legitimate needs at times, even beyond this, where God's solution was, I'm going to do my thing, and it's going to be my way. Because you think about the times that Israel marched around a city. Is that the typical method and means by which you besiege a city? No. That's not a good guidebook to use for modern warfare or antiquity warfare or anywhere between. That's God's method. And there's a lot of that to see here, but we can see it on the spiritual side the way that He works with us too. We are Israel. We are the spiritual Israel of God. And so their journey is a reflection or an advanced illustration of ours here and beyond. Chapter 17 is where we're going to be able to scoot into just a little bit. And it is both a powerful moment, but it's also a little bit of a foretelling one. Because water that comes forth from the rock is the closure moment for Moses too. But you see Israel doing their same thing, right? Moses, I'm going to die out here. I have a hard time as a parent not hearing Israel as children, by the way. Mid-teenage children, you know, about age 11, the preteeners, all the way about to age 17. That's how I hear Israel's complaints. So if my voice makes that kind of teenage sound for you, I'm sorry, that's kind of how I hear them. And we're going to die out here. You brought us out to die. Are they exaggerating? Yes and no. That's a legitimate feeling for them. And are they back in Goshen where things were plentiful in their mind? Not really that they were plentiful, but they believed that they were plentiful. Raise your hand right now that if I dumped you with what you have in your pockets, whatever that is, in the woods for a week, you would come back better off than you are right now. But whatever you have in your pockets, and I dump you in the woods for a week and you can't leave, and you'll be well fed and not dead. Let's go lower the standard. A week, I'm good. Can I survive a week in the woods with what I have on my body right now? I'm good. 2 weeks. Maybe. 3 weeks. You know why the 3 weeks is the barrier for me? Food and water. I can probably get food. I've eaten some things. If it's got legs on it, you know, I could probably eat it. Water is hard. Clean, fresh water is hard to accomplish. If I have fire, I could stay a long time. But right now, I have limited means to produce fire on my person. So I have to be honest and say that would be a struggle. Hundreds of thousands of Israelites in a wilderness where they were a slave people beforehand, though familiar with the lifestyle, how are you going to water them? How are you going to give them the water they need? Where their wells going to come from? Wells are a huge deal in Mesopotamia. Huge. Bad water. Anytime you go to a place and you have that queasy feeling of indigestion that maybe I shouldn't eat that, times a thousand. The pathogens that exist, the biologicals that exist inside bad water. While I've eaten some things, I've also drank some things. That had some things I probably shouldn't have been swallowing. That's what river life does that to you. There is a risk there. So when they talk about bitter water, when they talk about need for water, it's not just merely a childish complaint, though there is some of that because God's already bringing food to them from the sky. He's already demonstrated that He can control the waters to make them walk across on dry land, that God has that capacity. So that's where the childishness comes in. But the legitimacy of, hey, this is an issue. And it's one that we haven't solved yet. You ever been in a leadership position where a real need comes up that you hope people would trust you because you've already done things trustworthy, but they're like, well, let's just wait and see how it goes. As a younger man, I was put in charge of some older men who had been doing a task for a long time. That's how every day felt to me. And then an old friend of mine told me, he says, you need to stop trying to lead and just follow what they're doing. They'll teach you how to lead. And I figured, hey, that's a lot. And they did. Because they knew their job better than I did. They were all well workers. They were all hardened men who worked outside on oil rigs for years. And my job was to run the little computer. You know, but I was in charge. You kind of figure that out here with Israel. They're trying to learn to trust God and to trust Moses. And up till this point in their history, they had trusted themselves more so and their familiarity, even as bad as it was. They trusted that. So with this experience here, this is another step in that direction of one more opportunity. All the congregation of the people of Israel, this is verse 1, chapter 17. We've got just about 3 or 4 minutes left, so we'll try to squeeze in part of this. Moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim, where there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." The text gives us some practicality to the event. No, we need water. We've gone from bitter water to no water. And you think about the masses of people that would be involved in this movement. No water, one person, one small family group, hey, stop complaining. We're moving through, we'll be all right. This will be all right. When does people become a mob? There's huge studies on this, but I'll tell you, when there's more than one complainer, that's when people become a mob. Because you got two complainers? How many listeners do you have? Enough that you'll have 3 complainers, 4 complainers, 5 complainers, and 50 complainers in minutes. It happens all the time. It happens that fast. Again, remember, Israel is not full of dumb people who have no idea what life looks like. They arrive at the camp. Legitimate question. Hey, where's the water? This is a normal, practical thing. And so their agitation rises up. And they go back to God. And again, you have this dynamic of, well, to go to God, we've got to go to Moses. Does God have a plan for them? He does. Has He made provision for this too? He does. But their faith is right here. God's way of escape is right here. And they haven't seen the path that goes between the two, just like you and I. That's it for our class time this morning. The clock says 9:45, so we'll pull off at this point too and call it at that point. We will be fully into chapter 17 next Sunday because Wednesday night is the singing night. So just want to connect that for everybody. Thanks.